Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.10, The Sultan and the Pasha. The sinking of the Ottoman-Egyptian fleet at the Battle of Navarino would fundamentally change the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Sultan Mahmud II. During his son Ibrahim's campaign against the Greeks in the Peloponnese, the Pasha had insisted to the Sultan that the Europeans were on the verge of intervening in the Greek War of Independence. Muhammad Ali had suggested that the Sultan could get out of this quagmire by giving the Greeks suzerainty and offering them autonomy as a principality. This would maintain at least nominal control over the Greeks and avoid running head-on with the great powers of Europe, which Muhammad Ali rightly predicted would be absolutely disastrous for the Ottomans. But the Sultan would not listen to his Pasha down in Egypt, and he insisted that the Greeks had to be completely crushed and that he would accept nothing less than absolute submission from the Greek rebels. Now, we all know where this is headed, and sure enough, the British, the French, and the Russians would indeed intervene, with the result being the near total destruction of the Ottoman and Egyptian navies. And in many ways, the sinking of the Pasha's fleet at Navarino was the real turning point when the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Sultan Mahmud, which had always been extremely shaky, began to just completely fall apart. There are a couple of reasons why the disaster at Navarino was the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I've been waiting for the moment when I could use that camel metaphor. It's not every day you're talking about a place like the Ottoman Empire where everyone uses camels, and when such a metaphor is actually appropriate. Okay, with that dumb joke now behind us, the agendas of Muhammad Ali and Sultan Mahmud had been at odds for years now. But they had kind of needed each other, as the Pasha had been bailing the Sultan out consistently by offering up his army for things like subduing the Wahhabi Saudi rebels in Arabia and for putting down the Greeks in the Peloponnese. And then, though Muhammad Ali was super powerful, he still needed the Sultan's blessing to give him legitimacy as governor of Egypt and the Sudan. Because of all this, the two men had continued to deal with each other over the years, but they both had always known that the relationship would ultimately be untenable. Now, because Muhammad Ali had been so successful at implementing modernizing reforms in Egypt, the Sultan somewhat admired the Pasha. Well, admired is probably not the right word, but he at least recognized the Pasha's approach as a winning formula, and he began to kind of copy what Muhammad Ali had done in Egypt with his own efforts to modernize the broader Ottoman Empire. For years now, Mahmud had tried to rationalize his military and create a European-style standing army, but this effort had failed largely because the Janissaries, the Sultan's ancient personal army of slaves, resisted these reform efforts. In fact, when Mahmud's cousin had been Sultan decades earlier, he had been overthrown and then executed at the hands of a Janissary revolt that broke out specifically because Mahmud's cousin had tried to bring about modernizing reforms to the military. So for Mahmud, reforming the military was quite literally hazardous to his health. And indeed, in 1826, while Ibrahim was executing his campaign against the Greeks in the Peloponnese, the Janissaries mutinied when Sultan Mahmud announced his own military reform project, because it was still obvious to the Janissaries that the modernization of the army along European lines would severely curtail their power. So obvious, in fact, that some argue that Mahmud actually intentionally brought about their mutiny so that he would have an excuse to do away with them. And with past experiences in mind, this would kind of make sense, and if this had actually been the Sultan's plan, it was an absolute masterstroke, as the Sultan was ready for the Janissaries, and he pretty easily put down their initial mutiny with his newly formed personal army. And then he used the revolt as a pretext to brutally repress the Janissaries through mass execution, imprisonment, and exile, killing some 6,000 Janissaries in the process. After their failed mutiny, historically dubbed the Auspicious Incident, the Janissaries were completely eliminated as a power within the empire, as Mahmud, in one fell swoop, put to rest what had been up to this point one of the most influential Ottoman institutions for about 500 years. Now, As you have no doubt already noticed, this is exactly the same thing that Muhammad Ali had done to the Mamluks 15 years earlier. And this is kind of what I mean about how the Sultan couldn't help but admire at least the accomplishments of the great Pasha down in Egypt, even if he ultimately wanted to do away with Muhammad Ali in order to solidify his own central authority. After doing away with the Janissaries, the Sultan then appointed Muhammad Ali's old rival, Khusrev Pasha, as the commander of his newly reformed military. And you may remember old Khusrev was the first governor of Egypt sent from Constantinople, who Muhammad Ali outmaneuvered and deposed during his rise to power. Likely due to their personal rivalry, Khusrev was a big reason why, leading up to the disaster at Navarino, the Sultan remained oblivious to Muhammad Ali's suggestions to negotiate with the Greeks to avoid a European intervention. So Ali would understandably come to blame Khusrev for the fact that his navy was now at the bottom of the Mediterranean. So after Navarino, with his old rival Khusrev clearly in the Sultan's ear, Muhammad Ali decided that his relationship with the Ottoman imperial government had finally broken, and he began to make preparations for some sort of confrontation. As we saw last time, the Pasha had already significantly transformed Egypt through his military reform projects that necessitated modernizing nearly all aspects of Egyptian society. After Navarino, these efforts accelerated to a considerable extent as Muhammad Ali began to put all hands on deck towards the goal of entrenching his position in Egypt against an inevitable crackdown from the Sultan. First and foremost, Ali needed to replenish his naval forces, which had been completely destroyed at Navarino, and this effort to rebuild his navy was the most dramatic example of the way in which the Pasha turned, like all of Egyptian society, towards his war aims. In the past, Muhammad Ali had always just bought ships from Europe to fill out his fleet. But now Ali decided he needed to build his own ships. So he put over 8,000 laborers, mostly convicts and peasants on corvée duty, to work at the port in Alexandria. Ali then hired a French naval engineer to head the project. And within just a few years, the Pasha would have a brand new fleet of ships ready to take on the Sultan. Along with building his military industrial machine, Ali also built new textile factories, expanded education with a special focus on engineering, and most famously, founded a medical training hospital that was led by, yep, another Frenchman, and you are probably picking up on the trend by now, as, like we saw last episode, the Pasha's military was being trained by the French officer Sèvres, aka Suleiman. And now his navy was being built by a French engineer, and his medical hospital was being established by a French doctor. The courting of European experts and diplomats had long been an integral part of Muhammad Ali's dramatic rise to power. But during the lead-up to his confrontation with the Sultan, his secretive dealings with Europeans became ever more pronounced. Over the years, Muhammad Ali had become somewhat of a legend within elite European circles, and many European travelers made the voyage to Egypt specifically in order to bear witness to this incredible man. Ali had for years now played into the Orientalist stereotypes that Europeans held of leaders in the Ottoman Empire, in order to win them over as allies so as to better protect his diplomatic position in Egypt, and to glean expertise from them in order to further build up the infrastructure of his domains. When important European visitors would come to visit the Pasha, he would put them through a sort of absurdist ritual meant to heighten the sense of mystery and myth surrounding him. Most famously, before meeting Muhammad Ali, visitors would be made to wait in a dimly lit antechamber with spooky candles and, like, no furniture. Then these visitors would be brought through one room after another, all similarly dark and austere, with the visitors never knowing exactly where the final destination would be. Then, in one of these dark rooms, the visitors would speak with a mysterious, shadowy figure in one corner of the room who would ask probing questions, allegedly to vet them before meeting with the Pasha. However, at some point during this conversation, this shadowy figure would suddenly reveal that the guest had, in fact, this entire time been speaking with none other than Muhammad Ali himself. Now having been thrown thoroughly off balance, the European visitors would have a conversation with the Pasha without really being able to see his face, as he would stay in a darkened corner of the room. Then, at some dramatic point in the conversation, Muhammad Ali would suddenly lean forward and allow the light to hit his face, and the Pasha's sinister expression would slowly come into view, and visitors would briefly catch a glimpse of Ali's legendarily probing eyes, which people often said had this, like, X-ray effect that made them feel like the Pasha could see right through them. Now, all of this dramatic play-acting was highly calculated on the part of Muhammad Ali, as he knew quite well the many prejudices of the arrogant European aristocrats with whom he was dealing, who all thought of Ottoman pashas as fickle Orientals who could easily be manipulated through waving fancy European riches and Enlightenment ideals in their face. This whole elaborate ceremony was meant to reverse this dynamic, and to, in one sense, play into basically all of the preconceived stereotypes held by these Europeans, while also subtly shifting the balance of power in the room, so that in the end it was actually these Europeans and not the Pasha who were being manipulated. Muhammad Ali would then heighten this all the more by saying cryptic things all the time. Like when questioned about the fact that he was illiterate, Ali would famously say, "The only books I read are men's faces, and I seldom read them amiss." This strategy of courting Europeans in a way that left Ali still in the clear position of power within a given relationship worked wonders for the Pasha as he developed numerous connections with European experts who would help him to build his army, his schools, his factories, and his hospitals. Along with courting European experts, the Pasha had also used this strategy to develop a wide diplomatic network. And as his confrontation with the Sultan drew ever nearer, the Pasha leaned more and more on his own diplomatic circle to make secret arrangements and to gather information on the happenings over in Constantinople, as well as in the broader world. So, after the disastrous defeat at Navarino, Ali began to hear certain things through his European diplomatic connections that would alter his calculations in how he planned to deal with the central Ottoman government. First and foremost, Ali was hearing about the efforts of Sultan Mahmud to modernize the Ottoman Imperial Army, which had begun with Mahmud's doing away with the Janissary Corps, and which now had developed into the building of a centralized standing army. The process of building a modern standing army in Constantinople would take some time, but this effort was clearly accelerating, and it was fairly obvious that the Sultan meant to use this centralized military force specifically in order to rely less on the military power of his governors. And of course, Muhammad Ali was by far the most powerful of these regional governors on whom the Sultan had had to rely in the past. To make matters worse for Muhammad Ali, as we noted earlier, this centralization of the military was being led by Ali's rival, Husrev Pasha. And Husrev was quite obviously copying Muhammad Ali as he sought to implement a European-style military hierarchy with an officer corps made up of European experts, the exact recipe that had given Muhammad Ali so much success over the previous decades. Now, the building of a standing army in Constantinople was clearly very concerning for the Pasha. But the other thing that Muhammad Ali was hearing from his European connections was more subtle, but potentially even more significant for the course of future events. Muhammad Ali was beginning to notice a change in attitude of the European diplomats towards the Ottoman Empire as a whole, and he began to notice that Europeans were increasingly discussing the long-term viability of the Ottoman Empire, and whether or not this great empire was long for this world. Now, what Ali is picking up on here will be huge, huge, hugely important. That's right, three huges for the future of not just the Ottoman Empire, but for global politics in general. Because these are the first whispers of the so-called Eastern Question that will not only come to rule the fate of the Ottoman Empire, but will also eventually drive the course of world history right into World War I. The diplomatic conundrum that would eventually become known as the Eastern Question is extremely complicated and extremely important. So complicated and important, in fact, that we are dedicating our entire next episode to working through it. But for our current purposes, it was becoming clear to Muhammad Ali that the wolves of British, French, and Russian imperialism were beginning to turn their leering eyes towards the weakening Ottoman Empire, and beginning to wonder what they might be able to pry away from it should it become a rotting carcass. When Britain, France, and Russia had come to the aid of the Greeks at the Battle of Navarino, it was really the first time that the great powers of Europe had all come together to meddle in the internal politics of the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Europeans, especially the Russians, had been meddling in Ottoman politics for years. But the meddling at Navarino was of a completely different degree, as the great powers had helped to carve an entirely new independent nation-state out of a central part of the Ottoman Empire. This was pretty unprecedented, and the ease with which it had been done got these wolves of British, French, and Russian imperialism basically salivating at the prospect of prying away territory from the Ottomans. The most dramatic example of this development came in 1828, just a few months after Navarino, when a French consul approached Muhammad Ali with a proposition in which the French offered to give the Pasha 10 million francs and 4 large naval vessels for the rebuilding of his navy in exchange for assistance in invading Algeria. Now, the French conquest of Algeria will, of course, become extremely important for future events in North Africa. However, the process won't really begin in earnest for another couple of years, and I am intentionally sidestepping it here because I plan to eventually do an entire season on the Algerian Revolution against French imperial rule. And plus, we already have quite a lot going on here, and I don't want things to get too muddled. But what you need to know is that Algeria is at this point under nominal Ottoman domain, and the French will, over the next several decades, invade and conquer the territory, eventually absorbing Algeria as a department of the French nation. This proposition of the French to Muhammad Ali represented the very beginnings of a long, drawn-out French colonial venture in Algeria. At first, Ali was actually open to this agreement, as he was eagerly trying to build up his navy and had deep connections to French diplomats and experts. However, the Pasha then got wind that both Britain and Russia strongly opposed this French plan, and so Ali decided to hold off on assisting the French. So all of this intel that was reaching Muhammad Ali led the Pasha to make a couple of decisions that would forever alter the course of Ottoman history. First, Muhammad Ali decided to not help the Sultan in his war against Russia, which had come directly out of the Allied intervention into the Greek War of Independence. Muhammad Ali was at this point not yet openly rebellious against the Sublime Porte, so he gave the usual excuses for not joining the war. But his refusal to help meant that defeat was all but guaranteed for the Ottomans, because Muhammad Ali had by far the strongest military force in the empire. Instead of helping the Sultan, Ali built up the strength of his army and navy and further secured relations with his circle of European diplomats. And then Muhammad Ali just kind of sat back and watched the Sultan get trounced by the Russians, likely rubbing his hands together and maniacally laughing while it all happened. And then, just a couple of years later, as the Sultan was licking his wounds, having indeed been soundly defeated by the Russians, Muhammad Ali finally played his hand and invaded Syria in November of 1831. The pretext for this invasion was transparently flimsy, and it was obvious to everyone involved that Muhammad Ali initiated the invasion as a preemptive defensive measure to secure his northeastern border against the Sultan, as any future attempt by the Sublime Porte to dislodge Muhammad Ali would have to come from Syria. This invasion of Syria instantly changed the relationship between the Sultan and the Pasha, as Muhammad Ali and his son Ibrahim, who was leading the invasion, were quickly declared as rebels. This invasion of Syria began at the eastern Mediterranean port town of Acre, which lies directly between the modern cities of Tel Aviv and Beirut. Ali's son and greatest general, Ibrahim, saw early success as he quickly put Acre under siege. This siege would last for months, and the Sultan's attempts to break it were easily fended off by Ibrahim. During the siege, Muhammad Ali began to truly reveal his rebellious self-confidence, as he famously said of the siege, "In a few days, Acre will be mine. If the Sultan consents that I shall keep it, I will stop there. If not, I will take Damascus. There again, if Damascus is granted to me, I will stop. But if not, I will take Aleppo." And if the Sultan will not then consent, who knows? Allah Karim, God is merciful. The obvious subtext here being that the next step after Aleppo would be to march on Constantinople itself. Now, the amazing thing here is that even if Muhammad Ali was more or less just posturing when he made this proclamation, this is in fact exactly what would go on to happen, as Ibrahim would take Acre in May of 1832. And then he would march straight on to Damascus, taking the city in June. And finally, just a short 3 weeks later, he would take Aleppo. Then in July, Ibrahim would lead his army across the Taurus Mountains and enter central Anatolia, meaning that Ibrahim's army was now in the heartland of the Ottoman Empire and was quickly marching northward towards Constantinople. Then, in a last-ditch Hail Mary, the Sultan sent the Grand Vizier himself to lead an army of the Ottomans' best troops in a desperate effort to stop Ibrahim. However, Ibrahim would deal out yet another devastating blow against the Sultan as he soundly defeated this army in December of 1832, and he even went on to capture the Grand Vizier himself. Now having defeated basically every single one of the Sultan's armies, and now holding the Grand Vizier as a prisoner, the situation was at this point truly threat-level midnight for our poor friend Sultan Mahmud. If he had wanted to, Ibrahim could have at that moment marched on to Constantinople and taken the city, maybe without even firing a shot. And this is in fact what Ibrahim wanted to do, as he frantically wrote home to his father asking for the go-ahead to take the capital so that he could, in his words, finish off the business. However, even though the idea was being thrown around of deposing Sultan Mahmud and replacing him with Ali's son Ibrahim, it was not at all clear that this is what either man wanted to happen. Because though Muhammad Ali had publicly predicted the course of his military victories in Syria, the incredible success that Ibrahim had seen on the battlefield against the Ottomans surprised even the Pasha himself, and he honestly did not really have a clear plan for what he wanted to do now that he was poised to take the Ottoman imperial capital. Because remember, Muhammad Ali had initiated the invasion of Syria primarily as a defensive measure meant to shore up his northeastern border. And then, as Ibrahim soundly won one battle after another, he was basically improvising on the ground and just kind of riding the wave of his incredible momentum that he had managed to muster. However, with Ibrahim's army poised to take Constantinople, the complete collapse of the Ottoman Empire was becoming a real possibility. And this fact transformed what had essentially been an internal civil war into a full-blown international crisis. In a last desperate move, the Sultan began appealing to the great powers of Europe to bail him out, at first approaching the British, who initially turned down his request, which then led to a truly incredible development as Sultan Mahmud asked the Russians for help. That's right, folks. The Sultan is asking the Russians, the most ancient imperial enemy of the Ottomans, to help him fight off Muhammad Ali. The Russians jumped at this opportunity because they knew all too well that they would be able to extract major concessions from the Sultan in exchange for basically saving his dynasty. The decision of Russia to help bail out the Sultan then sent off alarm bells in the diplomatic circles of Paris and London, as Britain and France both had as a top priority halting the imperial expansion of Russia at the expense of the Ottomans. We saw this same dynamic play out during the Greek War of Independence, and it was really the primary reason why the British, French, and Russians all ended up helping the Greeks, as the British and the French wanted to get involved specifically in order to check Russian ambitions. Well, the same thing is happening once again, and spoiler alert, this will continue to define the next several decades of Ottoman-European relations. And French and British diplomats began to demand that Muhammad Ali halt his military expedition because they did not want Ali to dismember the Ottoman Empire, as that would very clearly lead to the southern advance of the Russians. With the great powers of Europe now beginning to align against him, Muhammad Ali told his son Ibrahim to halt and ordered him not to march on Constantinople. Then, with his son firmly in control of a large portion of the Ottoman heartland, Ali began to work his diplomatic magic. These negotiations would culminate with the Convention of Kutahya in May of 1833, in which Muhammad Ali was granted all of Syria, as well as the province of Adana, in the strategic region of southern Anatolia. And then the Sultan also reconfirmed the Pasha's control of Egypt and the Sudan, the Hejaz, and the island of Crete. This basically left Muhammad Ali personally in control of more territory than even the Sultan himself. And plus, he now ruled over some of the most important domains of the Ottoman Empire. To begin with, Ali, of course, controlled Egypt itself, which was one of the most strategically located provinces of the entire empire, connecting Mediterranean Europe to southern Asia, most importantly to British India. And now, Ali also controlled Syria, which not only had many natural resources, but also left the Pasha as the master of all of the Holy Lands within Ottoman domains, as he was firmly in control of Mecca and Medina in the Hejaz, and then after taking Syria, he now ruled Palestine as well. For centuries, control over the religious pilgrimage routes of the Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Hejaz and Palestine brought great prestige to the Ottoman Sultan. And now Mahmud had lost all of that territory to Muhammad Ali. However, even though Ali had seen his fortunes rise beyond even his own wildest dreams, as time went on, his situation became ever more precarious. To begin with, the arrival of Ibrahim's armies in conquered areas meant the introduction of conscription into the Pasha's armies. Over the next several years, there would be major resistance to this conscription policy as several revolts broke out, first in Crete and then later in Syria. Ibrahim was always successful at putting these rebellions down, but he often had to be pretty ruthless. So the arrival of Muhammad Ali's armies was unpopular to say the least, and they were having a lot of trouble maintaining control over their new domains. Then, on top of all of this internal unrest, the Pasha began to feel several different economic pressures set off by a cholera epidemic and several years of devastating floods and plagues. This created a situation in which the Pasha became stretched way too thin, with his armies spread out across a massive amount of land, and with his revenues decreasing, so that he was now having trouble keeping up with the cost of occupying such a large amount of territory. In response to these pressures, Muhammad Ali did bring about several administrative reforms that mainly centered around the loosening of his monopolies on certain industries, as he sold off large tracts of agricultural land to members of his elite class in order to help ease his financial burdens. These reforms, coupled with Ibrahim's ruthless suppression of regional unrest, did somewhat settle things down by the end of the 1830s, so that in 1838, the Pasha was again confident enough to announce his intention to declare independence from the Ottoman Empire in 1838. Though Muhammad Ali once again found that the great powers of Europe were not receptive to this declaration, and Britain especially was committed to keeping the Ottoman Empire somewhat intact, mostly because they were afraid of a major European war over the spoils should the empire fall apart. The Pasha once again proved himself to be very sensitive to the desires of the great powers, knowing that his fate was very much tied up in their diplomatic games. So Ali quickly put aside these aspirations for independence and began to pursue a new strategy that would eventually see success. For years now, Muhammad Ali had been growing increasingly distressed about the fate of his great Egyptian empire once he died, because Ottoman territories were always ruled by governors appointed by Constantinople. As we know all too well, the Pasha had zero faith in the central Ottoman government's ability to rule over his domains. And to put it bluntly, he felt that once he died, they were bound to just kind of muck it all up, and all his hard work to modernize the country would be for naught. With these anxieties in mind, Muhammad Ali hatched a new idea to seek hereditary rule in Egypt so that he could pass down control of the Egyptian provinces to his descendants, a setup that was completely unprecedented within the Ottoman system, as there were no such family dynasties in the empire except for the Ottoman dynasty itself. So publicly announcing these desires to begin a hereditary dynasty in Egypt was a bold move, to say the least. But Muhammad Ali was a bold guy. As Muhammad Ali was making public his intentions to seek hereditary rule in 1839, a bunch of things happened all at once that would once again escalate tensions between Muhammad Ali and the Sublime Porte. First, the Sultan was feeling newly confident in his army, which Mahmud had finally had some success in modernizing, having employed the help of a Prussian army officer. So with this Prussian officer acting as a consultant for the campaign, the Ottomans attacked Ibrahim's army in southern Anatolia in June 1839 with the hope of driving Muhammad Ali's forces back into Egypt. As usual, though, Ibrahim easily fought off this attack. But then, just a week after this failed campaign, the truly incredible news came when Sultan Mahmud II suddenly died of tuberculosis. Mahmud had ruled for over 30 years, and he had been the driving force behind many early Ottoman reforms, especially surrounding the modernization of the military. And as we'll see, his reform efforts would set the tone for the next several decades as the Ottoman Empire entered into the so-called Tanzimat era, defined by these reforms initiated by Mahmud. For now, though, Mahmud's death was a major source of instability for the empire during a time of already immense instability. And the timing really couldn't have been any worse, as his death came just a week after Mahmud's gamble in trying to dislodge Muhammad Ali. Upon the Sultan's death, Mahmud's teenage son, Abdul Majid, was declared Sultan, and the young ruler was almost immediately being led by forces behind the scenes, most especially by Muhammad Ali's lifelong enemy, Khusrev, who was appointed by the young Sultan as Grand Vizier. Then, to complicate matters even further, the Grand Admiral of the Navy, who it turns out owed much more loyalty to Muhammad Ali than to Ali's rival, Khusrev, or to the Sultan for that matter, defected the entire Ottoman Navy to Muhammad Ali in direct protest of the appointment of Khusrev as Grand Vizier. All of these developments created yet another international diplomatic crisis centered around Muhammad Ali. Amidst this crisis, the new teenage Sultan Abdul Majid would actually offer Muhammad Ali his requested hereditary rule. But this was to be in exchange for returning nearly all of the territory that the Pasha had won over the past several years, as he would be forced to return Arabia, Crete, southern Anatolia, and all of Syria back to the Sultan. With his deep diplomatic connections, and with Ibrahim's army still winning handily on the battlefield, Muhammad Ali knew he held an enormous amount of leverage over the Sultan and his Grand Vizier. So he rejected this initial proposal and resumed hostilities against the Ottomans. During the fighting, Muhammad Ali also used his connections to put pressure on the Sultan to get rid of Khusrev as Grand Vizier. And this effort actually worked, with Khusrev being dismissed in May of 1840. However, even with these diplomatic and military victories in hand, it was becoming increasingly clear to both Muhammad Ali and his son Ibrahim that the great powers of Europe were once again aligning against him. We're going to talk a lot more about this next week, but to put it simply for now, both the British and the Russians, each for their own reasons, felt that maintaining a weak Ottoman Empire whom they could easily manipulate and push around was in their best interest. And so what was not in their best interest was the prospect of Muhammad Ali taking control of the Sublime Porte with a powerful modernized Egyptian army, as this would potentially reinvigorate the empire and make it much harder for Britain and Russia to bend the Ottomans to their will. The French, for their part, were at least nominally allied with Muhammad Ali. We've noted Ali's connection with French experts and diplomats many times now. But the French began to feel that they were alone in their backing of Ali, and ended up not really doing a whole lot to help the Pasha. So Muhammad Ali's position became ever more isolated on the international stage. This diplomatic crisis, referred to as the Oriental Crisis, reached a climax when the British Navy, in response to Muhammad Ali's refusal to accept the young Sultan's terms, bombarded Beirut and invaded Syria. Then things really began to fall apart for Muhammad Ali when, simultaneous with this British attack, uprisings began to spread throughout Syria. With these losses in Syria, Muhammad Ali and Ibrahim could feel the turning of the tide and decided to go to the negotiating table. These negotiations, which were overseen by the great powers, finally resolved the crisis by offering Muhammad Ali hereditary rule over Egypt and the Sudan in exchange for returning the Ottoman navy to the Sultan and for giving back to the Sultan the territory of Syria, Crete, and the Hejaz. So the decade-long conflict between Muhammad Ali and the Sultans, Mahmud, and later his son Abdul-Majid, all ultimately led to this intervention of the great powers in the Oriental Crisis of 1840. And the settlement coming out of this crisis would have major ramifications for the future of the Ottoman Empire. First and foremost, with the securing of hereditary rule, Muhammad Ali had carved out Egypt as an autonomous province that would basically act as a de facto independent state, only owing the most nominal allegiance to Constantinople. As we will see, this will become very important as the British, who had just been instrumental in creating this settlement, would grow ever more interested in Egypt as a colonial possession. And over the coming decades, Muhammad Ali's dynasty will become ever more entangled with this British imperial presence. And ultimately, it would be a descendant of Muhammad Ali, King Farouk I, who would be overthrown in the Egyptian Revolution of 1952, that would set off a wave of revolutionary activity across the Arab world. But that is a story for another day. For our immediate purposes, the other important development to grow out of the Oriental Crisis was that Sultan Abdul-Majid had basically been bailed out by Russia and Great Britain, and this would lead to the ever-increasing influence of Western powers over Ottoman internal affairs in the coming decades. So next week, we will consider this growing interest of the European powers in the fate of the weakening Ottoman Empire. And this interest would create the so-called Eastern Question that would dominate relations between the Ottoman Empire and Europe all the way up until World War I, when the Eastern Question would be a major factor contributing to the outbreak of hostilities between the great powers in 1914. But before that fragile peace agreement can be blown up, we have to see another fragile peace agreement get blown up first. Because the uncertain fate of the crumbling Ottoman Empire will be the reason why the post-Napoleonic Peace of Europe, established way back in 1815 at the Congress of Vienna under Chancellor Metternich, will fall apart, as the Eastern Question will lead to the first major hostilities between the great powers since the defeat of Napoleon, with the outbreak of the Crimean War.